First of all, we'd like to thank Tia Chucha Cafe Cultural for providing the space for us. And thank you all very much for coming to Sherman Austin's first public appearance since being released from federal prison. Sherman is still on probation, and one of the conditions of his probation is that he shall not knowingly associate with anyone who espouses violence or physical force as a means of achieving political change. So, seriously, if we have anyone there espousing such notions, we really need to ask you to leave. With that business out of the way, please welcome Sherman Austin.
Thank you for the introduction. My name's Sherman Austin. I guess I'll talk a little bit about the history of how everything happened and where it's at today, what led up to, you know, present time today. As I'm sure a lot of you know, RaceTheFist.com was founded. I started RaceTheFist.com, the website, actually in the year 2000, around February, on President's Day, actually. And back then, it was more of just a smaller website, mostly different articles that mostly talked about things that were happening locally in the community and things going around the world as far as, you know, U.S. imperialism, police brutality. It covered, you know, things like the Democratic National Convention that was going on later that year that happened in August. And the site actually started to become a lot more popular later in the year. And during that time, a lot more government agencies started to monitor the website. And, you know, as time went on, the site progressed. And, you know, more and more people started coming to the website on a daily basis. And it turned more into, you know, an open, you know, basically like an open forum. Each article on the website was something that, you know, people contributed. It was a website that was, you know, very much composed of other people's opinions and other people's articles that they can automatically publish to a newswire that was on the website. And so people could, you know, just basically publish these articles and then, you know, participate, you know, in a form of dialogue at the bottom of these articles and, you know, share their opinions, you know, the critique or, you know, whatever they wanted to talk about. And, you know, Raise the Fist was, you know, more and more becoming, you know, a voice for people, not just, you know, locally in Los Angeles, but people from all around the world came to the website and, you know, voiced their opinions, talked about things and coordinated with one another, organized with one another. And, you know, so on. And, you know, as more and more people started coming to the website, more and more government agencies started coming to the website. And not just U.S. government agencies, but, you know, international government agencies as well. You know, as far as I can remember, I mean, I was getting hits from government agencies in Israel, Japan, Canada, France, you know, Belgium, Germany. You know, it's all over the place. And, you know, a lot of hits coming from the Department of Defense, you know, Australia, you know, straight from the FBI, even local authorities, local police. And, you know, so, you know, they were definitely watching the site as it started to progress and become a lot more effective. So what I think one of the things that actually concerned them was that people were coming to this website and it wasn't just a website where people would just, you know, talk about things and just talk about their opinions and, you know, what they thought was wrong and, you know, what we thought we should do. But it was a website that more of advocated that we, you know, do something about it. We take a direct role in, you know, what we're saying and, you know, put our words to action, you know, basically, you know, if we're not just going to talk about this, we're going to organize locally within our communities. And that's, you know, essentially what the website was. It was more of, you know, it was more of a tool. It's more, you know, of a resource for people to organize with one another and, you know, network with each other, you know, locally and internationally and, you know, around the world. And, you know, this concerned, you know, the FBI and other government agencies, especially in other countries where other people were coming to this website and also organizing. So, you know, as things went on, things progressed and the website became a lot more popular. And on January 24th, 2002, the FBI and Secret Service of the Joint Terror Task Force pretty much surrounded my home while I was asleep, taking a nap later in the afternoon. And they had their guns drawn. They had the whole house surrounded with submachine guns, handguns. They had bulletproof vests. From what I heard, they had, you know, Secret Service had cars parked all the way up and down the main street on the side street. They had all their FBI cars parked on the street pretty much. Everyone was on, you know, the front of the house, basically surrounding the house before they came to the door with their guns drawn. And they just basically asked if I was Sherman Austin and, you know, pulled me outside. And at that point, they all just came into the house and, you know, basically ready the home. And I went straight to my room where I was actually running the network that was hosting RaiseTheFist.com. It was a computer network, a small computer network hosted off, running off a home DSL line, which is another, you know, kind of interesting thing. It was, you know, despite, you know, the traffic the site was getting, you know, it was only hosted off a residential DSL line, which, you know, some points made it slow, but it actually worked, which was kind of a neat thing. But, you know, they came in, they dismantled everything, took apart the entire network. And during this time, I was interrogated for about 5 hours during the whole process. And I was asked certain questions, such as one of the Secret Service agents asked me if I was he asked me if I wanted to see the president killed. And, you know, they asked me other questions like, you know, the contents on the computer. And, you know, I asked them, you know, what was the reason why they came? How can they legally come, you know, because of a website, because of, you know, freedom of speech? And they said, well, under the U.S. Patriot Act, they can now come. They now had, you know, legally they can come to my house and seize all the equipment because of the contents on my website, which contained information about explosives. And, you know, I said, you know, wait a second. There wasn't anything on my website that contained information about explosives. And they brought up another website, which I didn't author, which was actually authored by a totally different individual. And I had nothing to do with the creation, you know, creation, authoring, or anything of this website. And they said this was the website. This was the initial reason why they had to come to the house and, you know, do the whole raid and, you know, all that other stuff. And, you know, I told them, you know, it was a link on my website to another website that had this information on it. And, you know, keep in mind that this website wasn't just a website that talked about bombs or explosives. It was a website that someone had put up for a protest that was going to happen, I think, in D.C. against the International Monetary Fund. And this website had about 7 different pages on it. And one of the pages contained, you know, not very detailed information at all, very, you know, immaturely, you know, written information about explosives, something they had obviously copied from another source online, or, you know, from what I heard, they copied it from Steal This Book. It was nothing you couldn't find anywhere else on the internet. I mean, you can find, you know, 10 times more information than what they said was the reason why they initially raided the house on any other website. I mean, there's thousands of websites that offer detailed information, you know, it's readily available to the public, that teach you how to, you know, make and manufacture explosives. And, you know, these websites are still online. I mean, from what I heard, you can go to howthingswork.com and, you know, all the information there, all the information is there, all the instructions are there. And it's a lot more detailed. But anyways, they used this as the reason, saying that they had to raid the house. And they asked me, even the FBI agent, John I. Pye, asked me about, you know, must have been 7-10 different times, if I was the one who authored the website that contained the information about explosives on it, which was called the Reclaim Guide. And I told him, you know, no, I didn't author it, like, very directly, you know, several different times. And, you know, he made his little note. And then, you know, everything lasted for, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours. And then they left. And everything was pretty much left ransacked. And, you know, they left with all the hard drives. They seized political literature, protest signs, and, you know, they just basically loaded everything into a big white truck and took off. And despite what had happened, I still continued my plans to attend the World Economic Forum protest in New York. And that was, I think, a week and a half later. So I left New York to participate in that event. And when I got there, I was waiting in Columbus Circle for the march to begin. And about, you know, 30 cops just, you know, blitzed the crowd, and they scooped up, arrested 26 demonstrators, one of which was me. And we were just basically taken to Brooklyn Navy Yard jail, where everyone was processed. And, you know, after about 30 hours, everyone was getting released. And I was taken into a back room in handcuffs and interrogated again by a Secret Service agent and a detective from the FBI. And I was asked questions such as if I was a terrorist or involved in any terrorist organizations, if I had known of any plans of violence that were going to happen at the demonstrations, how I got to New York, what trains I took to get into Lower Manhattan, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, they kept bringing up questions about the raid in California. And it looked to me as like they knew I wasn't a terrorist. They were just trying to get me to say, just trying to get something to make it look like they caught something, they caught someone, they got a big catch or something, you know, get a feather in the cap or whatever. But, you know, that whole interrogation process lasted a few hours. And then they said I wasn't going to be able to leave New York until they searched my car. And, you know, at that point, you know, I said I had nothing to hide. You know, there's nothing in my car that I believe is, you know, will incriminate me in, you know, any form. And so, you know, I signed over the keys and, you know, about 5 minutes later, I was taken to the courthouse and released. And while I was at the courthouse, I was waiting for about 30 minutes for someone to come and pick me up when a few FBI agents came into the courthouse and said I was arrested for posting information on the internet about explosives. And they basically, you know, grabbed me by my neck and hurried me out of the courthouse into this black SUV and drove me off to a federal building and tried to question me again. And then put me in maximum security 24-hour lockdown in the Manhattan MCC, which is like a federal jail. But they have a maximum security unit there where they, from what I heard, they actually were keeping the same people involved in the USS Cole bombing and the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Kenya on the same cell block I was at. And it was, you know, maximum security 24-hour lockdown. I mean, you can't come out of your cell at all during the entire day. It's a small, dark cell that was, you know, pretty much infested with, you know, a lot of roaches. It wasn't very clean. And the air ventilation system was very bad. And, you know, just keep you locked up in there 24 hours a day. And I was in that for about 2 weeks. And during that time, I had a bail hearing. And they basically denied me bail, saying I was a threat to the community. The FBI said I was a man on a mission. I came to New York to carry out, you know, my plot, and they couldn't let me out because I was going to return. On my way back to California, I was going to stop off at Utah for the Olympics and, quote-unquote, you know, blow up the Olympics, burn the Olympics, as they said. So they rendered me a, you know, threat to the community and denied me bail, and I was set to be extradited back to California to face my charges. And on my way back to California, I was waiting in Oklahoma, which is used as a federal transfer center for federal inmates before they reach their designated institution or if they're being transferred back to wherever their charges originate from. And I was there for about 48 hours. And the prosecutors then decided not to issue any kind of indictment. So, right when that happened, you know, I was just basically released. Despite all the articles that appeared in, you know, all the mainstream newspapers like the New York Post and, you know, the LA Times and stuff, and saying I was a terrorist and saying, had the headlines of like a baby bomb bus and, you know, they had caught a teen terrorist at the demonstration and I was, you know, had all these bombs with me and all that. And, you know, they played it up to make it look like, you know, I was a, you know, a pretty serious terrorist on some kind of mission. And then all of a sudden I was just released and I just flew back home on an airplane back to California by myself. And, so I wasn't on any kind of probation or anything. So as soon as I got home, I got RaiseTheFist.com back online. And that site was back online, and I just kept continuing my organizing work within the community. And at this point, Raise the Fist got a lot more people's attention because of what had happened with the FBI, and a lot more people started coming to the website. And this caused, you know, the website to grow a lot, and it started to develop more into just the website, but a direct action network. People started forming their own chapters within their schools and, you know, their communities called Raise the Fist. And, you know, these chapters were, you know, pretty much organized within their own communities, get people together, whether it was just, you know, just people coming together, talk about, you know, certain issues happening in the community or actually doing something about it, setting up different programs in the community, you know, food programs, organizing different events, demonstrations, and, you know, so, you know, a lot of different stuff like that. And, you know, as time went on, it was about 6 months this was going on. And, you know, Raise the Fist got a lot more well-known, and it grew a lot. It developed a lot into a direct action network. And chapters were, you know, at this point all around the world. I mean, there was a chapter in Brazil, Germany. There was, you know, several chapters in the States. And people were really, at this point, Raise the Fist was, you know, really becoming a tool and a resource for, you know, not just people who are already involved in, you know, the movement or, you know, pretty well-involved activists, but people who are actually, you know, pretty apolitical and, you know, not really knowing what was going on. I mean, the website really turned a lot of people on and got a lot of people involved. And the website became, you know, so much of a resource and a tool for people to organize with one another and coordinate with one another and network with one another. And, you know, it developed more to, you know, a network, a direct action network. And, you know, during this time, you know, I also continued my organizing work in the community. And, you know, there was some harassment also during this time from, you know, local authorities, local police. At the time, I was living in Long Beach, and, you know, I must have been stopped by cops on the street during that period, like, at least 4 or 5 times. And, you know, one of the times I was just riding my bike down the street, and I was stopped by one cop in a car, and then he radioed 2 other units to come over. So it was basically 3 cops stopping me on my bike, and they all knew my name. They're like, "Hello, Austin," you know, asking me why I hate cops so much, and, you know, just, you know, being kind of antagonistic and asking me questions about Raise the Fist, about different postings that were on there, and just trying to, you know, argue with me and stuff like that. And over a simple, you know, bike ticket for not having a bike light. And, you know, I asked them, you know, "How do you all know my name? You know, what's the deal here?" You know, they just told me, you know, my picture's hanging up in the police station, in the Long Beach police station. And apparently all the cops there, knew me as, you know, the so-called leader, the anarchist leader of the, you know, Long Beach movement or whatever, which is kind of odd because, you know, it's not really, you don't really have, you know, a leader in an anarchist movement. Like, but I guess that's what the cops looked at me as. And, you know, I'd hear all sorts of crazy stuff. I mean, other people I knew, other activists and anarchists would have run-ins with the cops, and cops would always be saying, "Oh yeah, you know, Sherman Austin? Yeah, we hear like he like runs everything. He's the leader." Like, I mean, they totally blew up this whole, this character of me. Like, I was the person running everything, and like, just because I had this website, when I was just, you know, I was just another person, you know, who just decided to, you know, voice my opinion, and I guess, you know, apparently got their attention, and I guess I was doing something right. But, you know, they played it up and made it look like I was this, you know, pretty dangerous anarchist that had to be watched and, you know, was up to stuff and, you know, needed to get out of Long Beach and stuff like that. And, you know, I couldn't even go to other friends' court hearings without getting within a few blocks of the courthouse and, you know, 5 or 6 patrol cars following me until I parked, and getting out of the cars, asking me questions why I was there, what was going to happen that day. And then I would leave, and then they would come to my car and, you know, look through the windows, you know, seeing what was inside. And during the entire time, police would just stay there, you know, staking out the car, seeing whoever comes and goes. And, you know, this type of stuff happened all the time. Where I was living at the time, at the Long Beach Info Shop, which was called the Reach Center, they would have, you know, gang enforcement units would just drive up and sit by the window and just watch people coming and going. They would have police just park across the street videotaping. Police would just, you know, drive by, you know, circle the block, you know, numerous times, follow people who came and went. They would stop people on the streets who were dressed in black, accusing them of being anarchists, search their bags. One person complained about having a gun pulled to their head and thrown to the ground because they were accused of being an anarchist just because they were in black, and they weren't even an anarchist. And this type of repression was, you know, intensifying a lot. And, you know, it was showing because, you know, people who weren't even, you know, affiliated with that center or, you know, affiliated with, you know, the work we were doing, came to the center complaining about how they were being accused of being an anarchist and, you know, had to be searched, had to have their bags searched and whatnot. So, you know, there was a lot of, you know, harassment and stuff going on from local authorities at the time. And, you know, those 6 months went by, and then my lawyer called me. At the time, I had a public defender, and he said the prosecutors called him up, and they said that they didn't really find anything on the computers they had seized from the house, but they didn't want to let me off the hook, and they wanted to proceed with some kind of pre-indictment binding plea agreement to get me to agree to distribution of information of explosives or weapons of mass destruction. And at the time I was like, you know, no way. I didn't distribute that information. That was something that another person created. That was a different website other than RaiseTheFist.com. RaiseTheFist.com didn't have any information on explosives on it. And, you know, there was a whole process of going back and forth about, you know, taking the plea, not taking the plea. Every time I resisted the plea, they would come up with like, "Oh, you'll be looking at, you know, It was first 2 years and like 3 or 4 years. And then, you know, as I kept resisting the plea, this thing came up about a terrorist enhancement, which would add on additional 20 years if I had gone to trial and was convicted. And during that time, that enhancement would be determined by the judge. Basically, if I had gone to trial, I would only be looking at 3 to 4 years if I had been convicted. But with this enhancement, that would add on an additional 20 years. So it would be like 23, 24 years. And so, you know, at that time, I didn't really have the resources to fight a case and, you know, face such, you know, 23, 24 years in prison. So I was pretty much, you know, coerced and threatened into signing a plea for distribution of information related to explosives or weapons of mass destruction for something I didn't even do. And it was a statue, by the way, that was written and sponsored by Dianne Feinstein, which passed in 1997 while Clinton was in office. But no, it had never been used before. No one had ever been convicted under the statute before except me. So basically, we went to court again, and expecting 4 months in jail, the judge denied the plea agreement, saying that he wanted the head of the FBI, at that time it was Robert Mueller, and the Justice Department to consult with the prosecutor on sentencing before the judge had made a final decision and opinion on what he wanted me to get. So we went back to court, and the prosecutor said that the head of the FBI and the Justice Department agreed with them on the 4 months in jail and 4 months in the community corrections center. And the judge obviously had his own plans, and he just sentenced me to a straight year in prison. And also before that, I forgot to mention, before this all actually went down, with the prosecutor contacting my lawyer at the time, my public defender, the FBI had actually interviewed the kid who wrote the actual information on explosives, the reclaim guide, 2 weeks prior to the prosecutors contacting my public defender. And they went to his house knowing who he was. So the FBI knew who actually wrote the information. They knew who they knew who actually wrote the explosive information. They know I didn't write the information at all. I mean, this wasn't about trying to convict someone who had written this type of information to put it out there. They obviously weren't concerned about that, because if they were, they would have prosecuted the other kid who had written this information. And for the reason he had written it for was for it to be used, as he explained on his website, for it to be used at the International Monetary Fund protests. So you can't really convict someone under the statute unless they have the intent, unless you can prove the intent that they had this information to be used. So it would have been so much easier for them to convict this other person, not just only on distribution, but with intent, because he straight out says on his website that this information is to be used for this event. And so they went to his house, interviewed him, and basically showed him pictures of the website, knowing that he created it. And, you know, he admitted it. He said he authored the website. He wrote all the information on there about the explosives. He showed him pictures of me and pictures of other people I knew, such as my roommate and other people, you know, who were supportive of my case. And, basically asked him if he had talked with me within the past, within the past 3 weeks. And he said no. And they're like, don't lie to us. We have logs. We know if you talk to him online, which is pretty interesting, because during this whole period, even before the raid, I had instant messenger accounts that were being hacked into. And, you know, I would receive threats such as, you know, your ass is going to jail. And, you know, they'd send threats to, you know, other people who are on my contact list, saying, you know, your ass is next and stuff like that. And a lot of times they would sign on to my screen name and I'd be blocked out. And then they would start talking to other people on my contact list, pretending like they were me. And the thing that was interesting was that, you know, they would sound like they're me. I mean, they would talk the same way. So obviously they were monitoring something. They had to have been packeting the DSL line, which was basically monitoring all the incoming and outgoing information going, you know, back and forth through the DSL line. And, they knew that, you know, there had been some kind of communication between me and this other kid prior to the FBI visiting him, because, I mean, they had logs of everything, and they'd obviously, where I'd been living at this time in Long Beach, packeting that DSL line as well and watching everything that came in and out of it. I mean, not that I had been involved in anything that would incriminate me, but this was just like ongoing surveillance that had been going on even prior to the raid. And, at times they would even knock down the website, knock down RazeTheFist.com, and blocked me out of email accounts that were used, that were associated, directly associated with the maintenance of the domain name, so that you couldn't route the domain name to the correct service for it to be, you know, basically visible on the internet, accessible to other people on the internet. So, you know, this type of stuff was going on for a while prior to the raid and prior to, you know, the sentencing. So, you know, that went on, and I was basically sentenced to a year in prison, and I was ordered to self-surrender 30 days later. And basically, I came to court, and 30 days later, self-surrendered. And on that day, Dianne Feinstein released a press release saying how happy she was that her statute was being aggressively enforced to convict me, an anarchist, for posting links on his website to another website that had information about explosives on it. So it's kind of interesting that Dianne Feinstein somewhat got the story straight, knowing that I didn't actually have the information on my website. She knew that I had only links on my website. I was only being prosecuted for a link on my website to another person's website that I didn't author. But still, she completely agreed, and she completely applauded the FBI's efforts and the prosecutor's efforts for, you know, convicting me, and the judge's efforts for convicting me for a year in prison for this. And I don't see the logical sense in that. I mean, she mentioned in her press release that she was concerned over a statement I made in a past interview, in a recent interview, saying that you can find this information on any other website. I mean, there's thousands of websites and books out there that offer, you know, much more detailed information on how to build, you know, high-powered explosives and how to manufacture them, how to use them, you know, picture diagrams on how to do all this stuff. And it's funny that she can sponsor and write up such a statue without even knowing that all this other information is out there. I mean, you can go to google.com and enter, you know, how to make explosives, and there you go. And I mean, Google has thousands of links to other websites offering, you know, much more detailed information on explosives. You know, they're not being prosecuted for anything. I mean, there's thousands of other websites on there that teach you how to make explosives, and, you know, they're not, you know, being taken to court. Their houses aren't being surrounded, you know, by FBI agents, you know, wielding submachine guns and shotguns and stuff like that. So, I mean, it was just obvious that this wasn't a case about, you know, explosives and the FBI being concerned about this type of information being out there with, you know, all the so-called terrorism going on around. It was about, you know, an anarchist. It was about you know, a voice that, you know, that became effective. It was about people coming together and organizing, using something that just wasn't a website, but, you know, a network, a direct action network that was a tool that people could start putting, you know, their words into action and start actually, you know, organizing locally within their own communities. And, you know, this concern of the FBI, it had nothing to do with explosives. It was just, you know, what we have seen in the past with, you know, political, you know, the persecution of, you know, activists from civil rights leaders to other radicals like the Black Panther Party. I mean, people being shot up, framed, you know, people who are still in prison today, you know, like Mumia Abu-Jamal and, you know, other political prisoners, you know, like Leonard Peltier, who have been put in there not for the reasons that they had said, you know, not for, you know, the petty excuses that they had thought up of and the things they had framed them for, but for the mere fact that, you know, these are people who had, you know, taken the so-called rights they mentioned in the Constitution, like, you know, your First Amendment right, and actually exercised that right. And at the point of which it started to become effective, that's when the government stepped in and said, you know, no, we can't have this. And, you know, basically, it just goes to show that, you know, you don't really have those rights, because when you start to exercise them, you know, they're taken away. I mean, the Black Panthers, I mean, I think they showed a good example of how, you know, those rights were taken away when they sought to exercise their rights. I mean, they sought to exercise the right to bear arms, and that was taken away. They sought to exercise, you know, freedom of speech in so many different ways, and they faced, you know, such incredible levels of violent repression from the state. I mean, they had their offices shot up, their members were killed off, picked off, you know, one by one. People started disappearing. I mean, they had so many infiltrators in that movement, just getting people framed, locked up in prison. I mean, they had psychological profiles on different members of the party. I mean, and this was because it wasn't because, you know, I don't think it really has anything to do with, you know, whether you're a communist or an anarchist. It has to do with whether or not you're, you know, creating change within the community, whether you're creating that sense of community control, because I think that's really the threat to national security. It's not, you know, terrorists or all this other stuff they're talking about. It's when you start to take control of your own lives and your own community is when you become a threat to national security, because you're no longer abiding to the guidelines within the power structure and the system, and you no longer, you know, following, you know, the, you know, what they have set out for you to do. And I mean, the Panthers started to create, you know, other organizations like the American Indian Movement started to, you know, create that sense of community control, and they started to revolutionize their communities, and, you know, started to create a movement that, you know, had the potential to carry out, you know, real social change. And that happens. There's been a long history in this country of, you know, violent political repression when people start to stand up, you know, against this, you know, blatantly, you know, brutal and unjust power structure. And I think just this case was just another example of that. And it just goes to show how we can't, you know, just, you know, stay silent. If anything, this case represents a need why we need to resist even more and, you know, stand up even more to this system and in this government, because things aren't going to get better. They're only going to get worse. And, you know, in the face of repression, I don't think we can really sit and think about, you know, if we need to withdraw or, you know, acquiesce in the face of fascism, because, you know, the fascists already have power. I don't think we'd have to worry about our movement bringing on fascism, because they're already in power. I think it's just a matter of how we're going to organize against that fascism, and how we're going to organize against, you know, this mass, you know, hysteria they've now created with this, you know, this new political agenda they've created with, you know, the Patriot Act and, you know, so-called terrorists, this keyword terrorist that they can use now to just basically trick anyone to thinking that, you know, we're prosecuting this person, this movement or this group of people are a threat to you and your community because they're terrorists and it's a matter of national security. And, you know, so I just think it's important that, you know, when things like this happen, we can't, you know, stay silent or withdraw. I think we just need to challenge the system even more. And, you know, so as I was saying, you know, I kind of got off track, but while I was, you know, basically sentenced, after I was sentenced, you know, I was in prison for a year, and, you know, because of my case, because of the fact that my statute, says weapons of mass destruction, it says explosives or weapons of mass destruction, but because of the fact that weapons of mass destruction is in that statute, I mean, it creates a whole nother security situation. For instance, when I was on my way being transferred to, my designated institution in Tucson, which was a medium security prison, I had to be placed in the hole, which was, you know, the special housing unit, which is, you know, basically 23-hour lockdown 7 days a week, which is where they put high security inmates or people who have been, you know, or other inmates who have, you know, been caught doing something for, you know, disciplinary action. But, you know, I couldn't be placed in general population because of my statute, because of my charge, and the fact that, you know, I was an anarchist and I was, you know, politically involved. And, you know, obviously it was enough to make them think I was either a terrorist or even if not a terrorist, just an anarchist, someone they couldn't have, someone who was, you know, basically a threat. So I had to be placed in a special housing unit. And even when I got to Tucson, I had to be placed in a special housing unit for almost a week because of my charge and because of the fact that even prior to being sentenced, that there was a lot of death threats going on from neo-Nazi groups and, you know, white supremacists, you know, basically saying they knew where I was at and, you know, there was a price on my head and whatnot. And these threats have been going on for a while. They have been going on for, you know, ever since I've been running RaceAtFist.com, but they'd increased a lot. They'd become a lot more direct and frequent during the last few weeks of my sentencing and the time I was turning myself in. And, you know, this created this whole crazy situation. It took like a month for me waiting in, you know, a small cell, like 23 hours a day, just to get let out into general population onto the yard and stuff, and basically have a little bit of room, a little bit more room to go outside and, you know, breathe air and stuff like that. So, you know, basically I was in Tucson for a year, in the middle of the desert, and, I basically served my time there. And, you know, going to prison is nothing rare. It's nothing new. I mean, going to prison for ridiculous things is you know, it's how the system works. I mean, the majority of inmates in the prison system are there for nonviolent offenses, and you have people in there serving 20-year sentences, 30-year sentences for nonviolent crimes, nonviolent offenses. And I mean, it's a system that's set up for you to fail. I mean, people get out all the time, and, you know, after serving 10, 20 years in prison, what are you supposed to do? I mean, how easy is it for you to come out and get a job and, you know, get back on your feet again? A lot of people, you know, with a felony on your record, it's so hard to get a job, find a career anywhere. a sustainable career that's going to offer you, you know, some kind of, you know, financial support to get yourself back on the feet in the world. And, you know, especially without having any kind of prior skill, I mean, you have to learn everything all over again. And it becomes, you know, this recurring cycle where people, you know, it's just a breakdown and people just go back to what they were doing before, whether it was, you know, however they were making money before that wasn't, you know, a legal source of income. And, you know, they violate again and go back into prison. And, you know, this whole thing is just set up for you to fail. And it became a lot more noticeable, I think, when I was actually, in the system and living it day by day and going through prison and going through the halfway house and just seeing how they set you up to fail. They don't set you up to get back on your feet. It's a recurrent cycle that make you come, you know, through the prison system. And there's people who have been living, you know, just through the system. I mean, I've met so many people inside who have just, you know, spent, you know, a third of their lives inside the system, just living in prison. I mean, there's nothing else they know but prison. I mean, that's what the system creates. And there's more people locked up in prison in this country than in any other country in the world. And, you know, the state of California alone has more people in prison than any other country in the world, with the exception of China. And I mean, it just goes to show that they just pack these prisons and, you know, they're so overcrowded. The prison I was in was originally built 20 years ago to hold one third of the inmates that it now holds. I mean, there's small cells with three inmates in them. There's triple bunks with three inmates in a small cell. I mean, it just goes to show that, you know, things aren't going to get any better. This prison system is just going to keep, you know, increasing the number of inmates that are coming in. And I think, you know, despite, you know, how bad the economy gets, there's always going to be two things. There's always going to be, you know, there's always going to be more prisons and there's always going to be more war. I mean, where I was at, they were building two other prisons down the street. Across the street, they were building a maximum security prison. Then down the street, they were building, you know, basically a concentration camp prison. They call them camps, but they're really labor camps or concentration camps. Every prison has, you know, makes inmates work, and there's different security levels based on what prison you go to. Where I was at was a medium security prison, and every inmate there has a job. And I had a job in the kitchen, for example, and I was making about 17 cents an hour. You're lucky if you make, you know, $1.50 an hour. You're lucky if you make, you know, $50 a month. And, you know, it's cheap labor. A lot of them, you know, contract out to Unicor, which is the major employer of federal inmates in the federal prison system. And, you know, a lot of people are working for, you know, sweatshop wages. And, you know, that just goes to show, you know, the type of things we're up against. And, you know, I'm just saying this just to show that, you know, experience it firsthand just made it that much more clear to me that, you know, when these types of things happen, when this type of political repression becomes this much more blatant in these times, we can't, you know, stick our head in the sand and you know, think it's a time that we have to, you know, completely lay low and stay silent. I think we have to organize even more and build a movement of resistance even more to, you know, overcome, you know, this system and this government and, you know, these blatant acts of, you know, repression and the things they're doing in our communities, not just here at home and abroad. The wars are waging not just on our streets, but, you know, in Iraq and other countries. So, you know, that's just basically the overview of my case and what I went through. And I think I was going to hand it over to my lawyer, William Paparian.
Well, Sherman has described what happened to him and the year that he spent in prison. When he entered into a plea agreement, a contract with the United States government, he agreed to plead guilty to the allegation he's described. And the government of the United States agreed to drop all charges against Sherman, including allegations of misuse of the computer and specifically possession of an alleged Molotov cocktail. When Sherman's home was raided, there were two Arizona tea bottles that were seized. One of them had 1 ounce of some petroleum product in it, and the other one had no petroleum product, but some charred pieces of paper in it. And based upon that, there was this allegation that Sherman was in possession of allegedly Molotov cocktails. What Sherman didn't know when he went off to prison was that the FBI agent who was in charge of the case, they call him the case agent, took his file across the street from the United States Attorney's Office in downtown Los Angeles to the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office at 210 West Temple, took an elevator up to the 18th floor, and presented precisely the same case to the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office for their consideration of filing state charges against Sherman Austin. Sherman had no idea that this had happened until February of this year, when his mother and her attorney had a meeting in the Federal Public Defender's Office with the FBI case agent to get all the items of personal property that had been seized from Sherman's home during the raid in January of 2002 returned. And it was there for the first time that Sherman's family learned that the FBI was pursuing state charges against Sherman. Now, did they violate the agreement? No, they didn't, because the agreement only said that the United States government was agreeing to drop all other charges and that that agreement was not binding on any other prosecutorial agency. So when Sherman was released from prison, I was engaged to act as his attorney for purposes of defending him against the possibility of state charges being brought against Sherman. The case was first being analyzed by what's called the High-Tech Crimes Unit of the DA's office. A deputy district attorney there was presented with all of the computer data. When the government raids a house, the first thing they seize is a computer. And they take the computer and they do what's called a forensic computer analysis. They transfer all of the data on your hard drive onto a government hard drive, and then they do an analysis of everything that's on the hard drive. And the High-Tech Crimes Unit of the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office took months in analyzing all of this data and finally concluding that they would not bring any charges against Sherman. That left the two Arizona iced tea bottles. And as I was negotiating with the district attorney's office, I learned that now the case was being transferred from the High-Tech Crimes Unit of the DA's office to the Arson Unit of the DA's office, and they proceeded to do their analysis. After we announced that we were having this event tonight, the first public meeting with Sherman Austin since his release from prison, today's date is November 4th, 2004, 2 days after the re-election of President George Bush, on Monday of this week, Monday, November the 1st, I received a telephone message from the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office advising me that they were dropping all possible state charges against Sherman Martin Austin. But the story of Sherman is not over with yet. All of the items of personal property that were seized from his home, we are trying to get returned. And since August of this year, I have been in negotiations with the assistant U.S. attorney who originally prosecuted Sherman in attempting to get those items of personal property returned. And they have agreed to return some items. We have not gotten adequate answers to all of our questions yet, and we are still pursuing very vigorously the return of all of the items of personal property that were seized from Sherman Austin. At the beginning of tonight's meeting, it was announced one of the terms of Sherman's probation, that he not knowingly associate with anyone who advocates violence as a means of political, social, or economic change. But that isn't the only condition of Sherman's probation. The other condition is that Sherman Martin Austin cannot have access to a computer or the internet unless the probation officer gives him permission to use the internet, and only under that circumstance where the federal government has placed a monitor on the computer to be able to track every single thing that Sherman does on a computer. Now, I want you to just imagine what your life would be like not being able to access a computer. Imagine being someone who's 20 years old who wants to go to college not being able to use a computer. Think about it for a minute. I did some research on this issue, and I wanted to take a look at what the courts in our country have said about the use of the Internet. And I want to share a few thoughts with you. One legal scholar commented on the Rutgers Law Journal that America is reacting generally to the omnipresence of cyberspace made possible by the rise of new forms of electronic communication. Specifically, the Internet, now past its infancy, comprises the backbone of American academic, governmental, and economic information systems. One federal court opinion had this to say: computers and Internet access has become virtually indispensable in the modern world of communications and information gathering. They did a survey last year, a group called the Pew Research Center. It estimated that there are 200 million users of the Internet in the United States. And the same study noted that 63% of American adults were using the Internet. That was last year. As of January of this year, the numbers have increased to 233 million users of the Internet. But here's what another federal court had to say about the Internet and civil liberties, because that's what we're really talking about here, is Sherman Martin Austin's civil liberties. This is what the court said. The architecture of the Internet as it is right now is perhaps the most important model of free speech since the founding of the Republic. 200 years after the framers ratified the Constitution, the net has taught us what the First Amendment means. The model for free speech that the framers embraced was the model of the Internet, distributed, non-centralized, fully free, and diverse. Through the use of chat rooms, any person with a phone line can become a town crier with a voice that resonates farther than it could from any soapbox. Through the use of web pages and news groups, the same individual can become a pamphleteer. Sherman Martin Austin cannot use the Internet. He is denied the right to use the Internet until his probation officer gives him permission to use the Internet, and only on those conditions that the government has installed a tracking device on the computer he uses so that they can know everything he does on the computer. It's quite an amazing story, what Sherman Austin has gone through. It could probably happen to anybody. It happened to him. And I think what you heard tonight was a very brave, very courageous, and very articulate young man. I've been very impressed with him and with his family and the care and support and love that his family and especially his mother has shown for him throughout all these very difficult and trying experiences that he has endured. I think with that, we're going to welcome questions from people here tonight. We're trying to keep the format down to 58 minutes because our good friends at the LA Sound Posse are recording tonight's presentation so that we can distribute it freely to the public. So Sherman, why don't you come on back up and we'll try to answer some questions. I think we want to use this microphone over here if anybody has any questions, or the microphone up here. The question is, why do I think charges were dropped by the district attorney? Well, I think if a case could have been made, the district attorney's office would have made it. That's their job. But they're only interested in filing cases that they can prove. I believe that an experienced prosecutor took a look at the evidence and realized there was no case to file against Sherman Austin. Specifically, the Arizona tea bottles, I don't believe they could ever convince a jury the possession of those items was a violation of the California Penal Code. 1 ounce of a petroleum product in one iced tea bottle and another empty iced tea bottle with some charred pieces of paper don't make a Molotov cocktail. Sherman, did you want to comment on that?
I think it's really important to understand and to become aware of the fact that the so-called Molotov cocktails started as two fully functional Molotov cocktails, which were broken down to one fully functional Molotov cocktail, broken down to one partially assembled Molotov cocktail, and eventually became components of a Molotov cocktail. And I can stand here before you today as Sherman's mother to tell you that my son was not making Molotov cocktails in his bedroom, nor did we have possession of any weapons of mass destruction on January 24th, 2002, when they came into my home, because they would have arrested my son. And there was no formal indictment ever held against my son in this case before he was intimidated into signing a plea. So I think I needed to make that really clear and make that statement that it's, from my perspective, this is a total intimidation by the United States government against my son to coerce him into signing a plea. And for whatever reason, Mr. Pai decided to shop this around in the district attorney's office. He found out very quickly that this time we have an excellent attorney who is willing to stand up to the system and challenge it. Thank you, William.
The question is, how did Sherman know that other government agencies, you mean in other countries, were watching his website, monitoring your website?
Well, actually, I had known that they had been watching the website, but I wanted to know for certain. So I created a script on the website just basically. Everyone who comes to a website, it interacts with the web server. And while it's doing that interaction, it goes through a form of protocol, and it sends back your IP address to the web server. So basically what I was doing, I just had a script on the website that would basically filter out all those IP addresses that were interacting with the web server and only log the ones that were coming from, you know, government agencies by just basically filtering out all those IP addresses and IP masks that ended with .mil or .gov. And when I did that, I mean, I just got a huge list daily.
Another question, Beck.
You know, it really is an object lesson of how the capitalist rulers use these anti-terror laws to target outspoken opponents and to basically those that would oppose imperialist war or racist oppression or anyone they just don't like. And you know, and it's, as he spoke of about Dianne Feinstein, it really represents how the Democrats have marched in lockstep with the White House in this kind of actions. And I just want to let people know that we have a very important issue of the Class Struggle Defense Notes where we published a brief on the Jose Padilla case, which I really encourage people to get a copy of and read. About this bogus war on terror. I mean, there's no more a war on terror than there's a war on obesity. It is a construct to basically allow an imperial presidency to disappear citizens. And the Partisan Defense Committee, in conjunction with the Labor Black League in Oakland, organized a United Front demonstration in February 2002 against the Patriot Act, where it offered a forum to unite both the backbone of the demonstration, which was longshoremen, the Longshoremen's Union, with day laborers, because it was also making a stand in defense of immigrant rights, in stating that, you know, this has to be opposed by all of labor. And
I guess so, yeah. I mean, yeah, I completely agree, definitely. I think that just important that, I mean, it's... The thing that I thought was kind of, you know, funny with, you know, Dianne Feinstein is that people usually see her as, you know, a more of a liberal Democrat. And while I was in prison, while I was in Tucson, I actually wrote her a letter after I saw her appear on CNN regarding what had happened in Iraq with the video footage leaking out with the abuse of the prisoners. And she was commenting about that in regards to the Geneva Convention, how we can't be hypocrites. Or, you know, how the U.S. government can't be hypocrites with, you know, the abuse of prisoners. And it was just funny that how she mentioned hypocrites when her own actions pretty much showed that, you know, how pretty much involved with hypocrisy, you know, she was, how pretty much she was involved with, you know, hypocrisy and being a hypocrite herself, saying that, you know, we have to be abide to, you know, the rules of... justice and like equality and these good values, and at the same time prosecute people for freedom of speech and lock them up in prison. And it just goes to show that, you know, a lot of politicians are just that, politicians. They'll come off, you know, a lot of them come off as more liberal than others, but I mean, from what I learned, I mean, from what I've seen also, I mean, when the truth really comes out, I mean, a lot of them just, they'll do what they're there to do. And, you know, she was there what she was there to do. I mean, it just goes to show, how are you supposed to trust someone at the same time? You know, it's like they're, you know, it shows how blatantly, like, two-faced, you know, a lot of these people can be when, you know, she makes such a statement like, we can't be hypocrites, you know, abusing our, you know, Iraqi prisoners, and, you know, saying how this, you know, whole scandal is terrible, and at the same time, you know, applauding the government for locking someone up for freedom of speech. So, you know, that's what I have to say about that.
We have one more question.
What advice would you give in light of your trouble you've run into for trying to assert your First Amendment rights and freedom of speech? What advice would you give to those who would like to do the same and hopefully not fall into the same bog?
Well, you know, at first I'd just say, just kind of be careful. You know, obviously if you're running the website like I was, you know, one of the reasons why I monitored all the government surveillance and all the government hits that were going on the website is because I could see exactly which articles they were looking at, in particular what they were interested in. I had events posted up on the website. I could see how many times they were looking at those events, how long they were looking at the articles, you know, how many times they went back to that same page. How they were getting there, how much they really knew the website. So I had pretty much an idea of, you know, where to expect them and, you know, and what for. So, I mean, it's good to be careful, but at the same time, I think that, I mean, you can't get to a point where you're just paranoid and scared and because you think they're watching, because, I mean, they are going to be surveilling you. They are going to be taking pictures, following you or whatever. I mean, that's just something we're going to have to accept if we want to, you know, voice our opinions in this society with this government. I mean, you're going to be profiled. You're going to be, you know, they're going to have the little list on you. They're going to have the little file on you or whatever. But I think that, you know, the most important thing is just to keep going and not give up. I mean, change at one point and requires, an inevitability. At one point it requires some kind of struggle, and you're going to have to get through, you know, some kind of struggle to achieve any kind of change you're trying to achieve. So I think that, you know, The more repression we face, the more you know, surveillance we face, the more, you know, erosion, or the blatant, you know, erosion of our, you know, civil liberties that they say we have, you know, the more we see that start to, you know, disappear, the more we just have to stand up, the more we just have to resist, the more we have to start creating forms of resistance in all sorts of different ways, all different tactics, strategies. Work within a diverse array of tactics and strategies to, you know, challenge the system in any way we can.
All right. Thank you all for being here tonight, and we hope that we'll be able to have more public appearances for Sherman to continue to speak out about his case. Thank you.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD, or you can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit 4, all.net. If you valued what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. Thanks very much for listening.